It's my great pleasure to be talking with Bruce Piasecki, the author of the book, The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. Bruce, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, my pleasure, Jay. It's good to be with you on this business journey.
One of the things that I'd like you to do right up front is help my listeners understand what you see is socially responsible for a business.
You know, the guys that helped set up the quality revolution, Deming and Juran, probably only got it half right when they modernized the car 30, 40 years ago, in the sense that they taught a lot of business people how to compete on not only price, but also quality. And now, having worked for more than 100 large firms, from a Warren Buffett firm in flooring to Toyota when we helped revolutionize the hybrid powertrain across 3 years, I've come to the conclusion that the cup is much richer in the journey of business, and it includes competing on price, quality, and social needs. And Jay, by social needs, I mean things like poverty. At HP, my work was very much about how to find the next billion customers, knowing that they would be poorer around the world. It also deals with competing on medical challenges, social needs like avian flu or swine flu. When I've worked with Baxter, that's very much what it was about. And even in this new Warren Buffett firm I work for, the $6.2 billion Shaw Industries, we're competing on the social need of recycled content because we're making carpet and flooring with 25% recycled content. So I think Deming and Juran only got it half right. The new sweet spot of innovation has to do with competing on price, quality, and social needs.
In a lot of ways, it seems like a common theme through your book is that competition has kind of led us down a slippery slope.
I think if it's too narrow, I mean, we all grew up learning how to fight in our little sandbox, you know, trying to find out how to be competitive in our neighborhood. And we all have come to learn about winning and losing. It's almost the very nature of being human and having humanity. So I've written The Surprising Solution is a colorful book. It's not a black and white technical book. It's a good read. And I'm actually trying to talk about the panic and the resolve of good leaders, developing a whole bunch of attributes of the thousands of executives that I've watched over the last 30 years. I've written a chapter called Developing Leaders We Can Trust, Jay, which is really about the people learning how to compete in this new century. So competition is natural. Competition that is broadened to look at the near future rather than just look at the quick win is a lot of what I'm writing about in this new book.
You don't have to look at the newspaper or watch television to know that we're kind of in a new era here. You know, profits are a lot differently recorded and estimated now. I mean, we really do live in a different era. And so do you believe that this era that is changing is also going to change our focus?
It will. There's a couple of things that are changing our focus, Jay. The first is we need to live in a carbon and a capital-constrained world. In other words, when you get 6 billion people living on the same spinning globe, the spin of your utility dial, the nature of your car, the nature of your computer are in this context of capitalism in which the best firms, the ones that are going to be given the license to grow further, are the ones that are going to respond to these capital constraints. And so we have to go back to Ben Franklin's kind of frugality. And although many of my books have been, you know, books that the White House used to amend federal laws, I've gone global in this new book, The Surprising Solution, because I've been traveling around to many of the megacities in the world. And I'm seeing that capitalism is being reshaped as we speak, that there's a new form of capitalism after Jeff Skilling at Enron or John Regis at Adelphi or Bernie Madoff, just the monster of the last few years in terms of his investment securities. The clock on bad management is close to midnight. And so what's happening is the clock on what is good management, how do you develop a leader that the public can trust, is very exciting. So my new book explores that type of leadership And you can get a sense of it in a new webpage that some leaders have put together called changethis.com, where you can get a 17-page sample for free, Jay.
And we're going to link that on our article, you know, on our blog post here, so that people can find that and be able to view that and to get a sense of that. But I want to pick up on something else you were getting at there, and that is, in the book even, you predict that in the next 40 years, which is not very long, the top 300 multinational corporations will go through a tremendous change, and only a minority of them that will remain. Why do you see that? Do you see that they're not able to change?
Well, you know, that's just what's so fascinating about capitalism and the fierceness of capitalism. When I started my management consulting firm in 1981, I took a list of the Fortune 500. You know, I was young, I was ambitious, Jay, I was hopeful. I put it in a folder when I created the S Corporation. Only a third of them still survive. Just in a matter of 28, 29 years, BP buys five of the other companies. Exxon buys Mobil. Dow buys Union Carbide because they bought the ranch from Bhopal, another tragedy that I had written about once. So I believe that by 2050, in the time when my daughter is my age, there will be another cleansing, a very rapid cleansing. My book is very much about this, a new S frontier of capitalism, where the swiftness of information makes it intolerant to underwrite non-competitive firms. They go out of business, and where the severity of the market reminds all of us that they need to compete on social needs rather than just current market conditions.
One of the things you talk a lot about is how a business needs to become truly socially responsible, not just for the PR nags out there. You're talking about so that everybody can understand it. What does that look like? How do they begin to move toward a more socially responsive agenda?
This might be what's the most exciting part of the book is take, for example, this Warren Buffett firm that I work for in the last 2 years as an internal facilitator of change for their top 26 people. There's only one person of those 26 leaders at this $6.2 billion Shore Industries that has the title sustainability or environmental affairs. All the other people are CEO. Vance Bell has written an endorsement of this new book saying that it's about the sweet spot of innovation and that it's right on target. His CFO is aligned with this approach. So is the COO. So are the profit and loss people. And so just like Ben Franklin understood the power of frugality in the early days of America, I think these recent financial meltdowns are reminding the surviving companies, the smartest companies, that they need to operate in a condition of efficiency, of capital efficiency, of capital constraint. My specialty, Jay, for the last 30 years is also then blending that with changes of value in society. And clearly, if you look at Toyota's pursuit of the hybrid powertrain, there's a whole chapter on that in this new book. The reason why they went and produced a car that's twice as far per gasoline mile as what the federal laws required, you know, the hybrid powertrain, the Prius or the Lexus hybrid or the Highlander hybrid, goes twice as far as the law required because Toyota understood how swift and severe the world was, that soon we were going to be experiencing $3 per gallon gasoline in the States. Soon there were going to be 42 non-attainment cities like Houston or LA where the smog was so bad. And so the firms that both big and small, I've worked for both big and small, that can relate to how value is shifting in society and how they understand that there's going to be both carbon and capital constraints, that's the new form of competition that I'm writing about.
My guest this morning is Bruce Piasecki. He's the author of The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. Bruce, I want to talk a little bit more about something I think you were just touching on, and that is leadership and the leadership understanding that they need to change. How do those leaders make that play out? How do they, first of all, understand it, and secondly, how do they communicate it to their frontline employees?
Well, the true feature of leadership, I think the most honest form of leadership, is leadership that admits that it is sometimes in a panic, and that $3 per guest mileage or the rising price of energy volatility, that these produce not certainty, but panic. And the trend towards globalization, where small businesses are either going to be swallowed up by the giants or learn how to surf in that context of globalization, where issues like money and markets are so volatile that thousands of firms are going under. I write in the context of establishing the new grounds of leadership in that horribly severe and stressful world. So, you know, last century, whenever a writer wrote about leadership, they thought of Abe Lincoln or they thought of somebody like Winston Churchill. What I'm writing about is we live in a new century where the largest economies of the world, the one in which most listeners are engaged by, are not actually government. Of the 100 largest economies in the world, more than 51 of them are corporations now, like Google or Walmart or BP or Exxon or GE, and they're not nation states. Now, what that means is that leadership has to become different. Leadership cannot just be about competing for market space. Leadership must also be competing for these rising social needs. And so things that used to be solved last century by religious organizations or philanthropic organizations increasingly need to be addressed, like poverty or avian flu or swine flu or you name it, by corporate leaders. And that's very much what my new book is about, is how do you create possibility? What that is the surprise in the solution, where the corporations that get it will go to the bank competing on social needs.
You mentioned that 51 of the world's largest economies are now corporations, and I would venture to say that a lot of my listeners are not necessarily in that higher air, so to speak, or that thinner air, but they probably are affected by those folks. But I would like for you to talk about how small and medium businesses can play on that larger stage. How can they still be socially responsible and yet be relevant?
Well said, and a great question. I want to answer it by telling a story. I mean, originally when I went to college, my real love was, you know, the beauty mark on somebody's shoulder and playing basketball, but eventually I thought I'd become a doctor. And an individual came to town that changed my life. His name was E.F. Schumacher, and I'm just 19 years old, and he's written a book called Small is Beautiful, Economics as if People Mattered. 30 years later, the surprising solution is my attempt to update that kind of approach. Even though mega companies are dealing with the flow of capital and the flow of products and goods in mega cities, I still believe that sanity, the way to outsmart a fear of the future, the way to keep sane, is to come back and ask, what can my company do? What can my family do? What can I do in the context of all this severity and this swiftness of change? And I think what you can do is to take control, to be more frugal, to be more deliberate. Like a surfer, my book is very much about helping people understand that some of the waves you got to just let go. You let them pass by. You'll be lifted up and go after the big ones that are going to give you a bright future. So I was very happy when Publishers Weekly called this new book a treasure trove of innovation for small and large companies, because although I am writing about a Toyota and an HP and some of the others I've gotten to work for, what I'm really doing is trying to share the principles of leadership in this smaller world.
Yes, companies my size, we don't have room for sustainability coordinator or something like that. That now becomes my role, part of my role, part of the hats that I wear every day.
Well said. And in fact, I'm seeing that there's a greening of founders, there's a greening of CFOs, and actually, Jay, it's a better greening because it's not an ideological greening. It's a greening based on efficiency. It's like Ben Franklin when he started his first printing press. He would deliberately walk through the market, you know, with his papers, taking it to the printing press, so people would see how frugal he was, in the sense that he wasn't paying for a vendor to do something. He was doing it himself. And I think that the principles that I write about, what makes them so surprising, And hopefully, you know, when I go around college campuses or when I go into these different nations, I get to go, because my last book, World Inc., made it into 9 different languages. When I go, I see these people are picking up on these principles. It's almost like going back to the things that their grandparents might have told them, so that some of it is ancient wisdom of frugality and some of it is positioning for the future.
Obviously, sustainability is tied to survivability. And I think that not only are customers paying attention to our agendas, but also investors are paying attention to our agendas. So I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about how social responsibility attracts investors.
Absolutely. And the first thing I'd like to say is that for 20 years, my firm, the AHC Group, has been holding these leadership workshops where the surprising solution is a popularization of a lot of these principles that I hear from the small and medium-sized people that take our workshops. So what we noticed about 5 or 8 years ago is that the investment community was becoming increasingly impatient with its capital. And it was on the buy side and also on the sell side, looking for management that respected efficiency, that didn't respect waste or bigger is better or a kind of giantism that could go mindless at times. And so in the last 2 chapters of The Surprising Solution, I write about money. One chapter is called Money Matters. And it's written in honor of my grandmother, who was a Polish immigrant, who, when she would say with her Polish accent, Prust, money matters, you could feel the physical weight of that frugality. To her, America was not about gold on the sidewalk. It was about gaining access to money for the first time in her life. There's a second chapter in the book called Money Will Not Manage Itself, and it's my popular reflections on what went wrong, because capitalism can become senile capitalism rather than advanced capitalism. And so in that chapter, I talk about the new rating agencies like Innovest or RiskMetrics or Dow Jones SAM or others like DNV. I went around the globe for 5 years interviewing the heads of these rating agencies. And what they're showing is that the investment community, the social responsibility investment community, is just the tip of an iceberg, I believe. It's not quite mainstream. It might be 1 out of every $10. But what's the iceberg is ways to do dashboards to invest in firms that are less risky. Toyota is less risky in the near future than GM, because GM overinflated its value, the record now shows, by at least $51 billion, while Toyota modestly positioned for the near future on cars that were produced through lean manufacture that got greater miles per gallon. So I think the investor community is beginning to pick up with this idea that the sustainable value is one that competes on price, quality, and some aspect of a social need, and that social need is wind in the sail of the firm.
Bruce, just one last thing. You made an interesting point in the book that I'd like you to answer to, and that is everything that you asserted in this book is more easily understood overseas than at home. Do we have myopia here in the U.S.? Do we have this isolationist kind of theory? What is it that drove your comment there?
Well, that's a great question. I love being an American, and I've really enjoyed the advantages of growing up in our great freedoms and our great protection. But I think what I'm writing there is as I travel to Greece, Athens, Greece, or Thessaloniki, Greece, or as I travel to places even as megacities like London or Istanbul last month, what I notice is that there's a readiness to understand that capitalism has already changed, that capitalism in this century, just in the 9 years of this century, is about competing in a smaller world. In America, we still have a little bit of the frontier mentality that the world is super abundant and the world is forever resilient. I think Europeans, definitely Asians, many people in the developing world have a different type of respect in that they may feel that the world is, in fact, abundant, but not super abundant. And they may feel, in fact, that Africa is resilient, but can also be vulnerable to issues of resource depletion. And so I have written that new reflection because I think the globe is proving with a set of higher facts that there may be a little bit of short-sightedness and a kind of cockiness that will be corrected in the American view of superabundance.
The book is The Surprising Solution, Creating Possibility in a Swift and Severe World. And the author is Bruce Piasecki. Bruce, thank you so much for your time today. Give my listeners a chance to find out more resources about you online.
I will indeed. I've shared with you, Jay, a few web pages. You can go to ahcgroup.com. You can go to worldincbook.com. And the most recent one is changethis.com, where a fair amount of information from this new book, The Surprising Solution, is available for free.
Bruce, thank you so much for your time today. It's a wonderful book, and keep up the good work.
Thank you for your time, Jay. It was fun.